We recently sent one of our A6 up into space, 500 kilometers up in low Earth orbit. That raised a lot of questions for us. What actually happens to silicon in space, and what is that environment really like? Can you test on the ground before you launch? To help us understand that, I invited nuclear engineer Matthew Gill to the Zero to ASIC weekly group call to help answer our questions. Matthew has spent years working on radiation effects, particle accelerators, and preparing electronics for space. We started by talking about what that space environment is really like.
Electrons, it's protons, and a bunch of heavier ions. So you have almost every element in the periodic table whizzing around out there at different energies.
As the conversation went on, we got into the practical reality of our experiment. Because our ASIC isn't shielded inside the satellite, it's literally exposed to space.
That's gonna hurt. That's gonna really hurt. They're just dangling it out there. Okay.
Yeah.
One of the things I found most surprising is that the environment isn't equally dangerous everywhere. There's parts of the orbit that are much more dangerous, and you can see that in real satellite data.
Save wherever they have a memory error. And if you go back through the GPS coordinates as to where that happens, there's a hotspot that's always here. So that's where a lot of stuff happens.
So with that context, let's jump into the full conversation with Matthew Gill and talk about radiation, reliability, and what it really takes for silicon to survive in space.
So I'm a nuclear engineer by background originally, and I kind of wound up in doing space stuff and radiation stuff in space via a fusion startup that kind of progression-wise, Halton and all the plasma physicists were in space propulsion people. So I wound up at an in-space propulsion company as a nuclear engineer, and I had a lot of experience with particle accelerators, so I ended up getting lumped with a lot of the radiation testing, which kind of turned from doing radiation testing has a lot of standards and code. So it turned from doing a lot of things per standards so that you could sell products to, big aerospace companies like Raytheon and Lockheed, right up to some smaller companies I worked with at the time, which were kind of like, were flying hardware, in a very quick and simple way, the way that you guys are. And they were noticing issues and they just wanted to kind of find those issues and fix them.
One of the questions that was asked the most often, so Sylvain and Troyburn and Sam and Rohan all asked, basically, how do you test this stuff without having to go into orbit?
Yeah, so there's two things that happen to parts. Basically, one of them is kind of classed under total ionizing dose. So that's kind of in your semiconductor, electron hole pairs are produced, and when you have a bias condition across it, that electric field like throws the electrons away, and the holes kind of stick around. So it kind of changes how the parts behave, and that's a buildup. So that's a parametric degradation, and that kind of builds up over time. So you see your parts slowly get worse and worse and worse as that happens. So typically that looks like on the simplest parts, like a transistor, the voltage threshold to switch a transistor slowly changes to the point when you can't change it. And that gets a lot more complex when you get into really complex integrated circuits and you see different behaviors. So, if you have a voltage reference, that voltage reference will drift and start change. It might even be linear. It might do some odd dancing and shapes and things. And then other parts, like really complex parts, tend to kind of like, they have parametric drift. They have, frequency changing on things which have like any kind of timing application. And then there's also things like they all tend to start drawing more current. They all tend to get less efficient and more hungry. So that's the TID side of things. And testing that's relatively easy. Like anything you can find that will give your part a total ionizing dose will be representative-ish. The standard way to do it is with a cobalt 60 source that makes gamma rays. The reason people do that is because it's generally one of the most severe ways to get dose. There's also like a lot of them around. It's also mostly done because that's the way it's always been done since like the 60s. So the standards don't really get updated very much. People are very conservative about this for obvious reasons. But you can do it with medical proton beamlines, electron beamlines. You can do this with X-ray sources as well if they can penetrate the parts. people seem to be less interested in using X-rays because, you know, it's kind of a bit hard to control. But if you want to see how it degrades, it's a very easy way to do it, because you can find X-ray sources like all over the place, basically. The other thing that's more complex is single event effects. So if you imagine on orbit, a lot of what we have is like it's basically electrons, it's protons, and a bunch of heavier ions. So you have almost every element in the periodic table whizzing around out there at different energies. And for a lot of those particles, as they pass through your semiconductor device, they kind of leave a charge track. They create lots of electron hole pairs. And if it happens in the right location, basically you kind of get like that charge track being created. And then the electric field kind of like giving a surge of current, and then it can kind of like switch bits is the simple thing. It's like you get an analog device's small transients, whether that's like a voltage reference having a very small spike or even a dropout for a very short duration of time. In more digital stuff in memory, you see bit flips. You then start to get in complex devices, other things happening where they call them, it's a catch-all called functional interrupts. And that usually just means that something resets, doesn't know what it's doing. Like an FPGA on orbit will reset all the time. It'll forget what it's doing or it'll freeze. And you can get right up to destructive things where you get latch-ups. So you go into a high current state that's sustained that can cause devices to either instantaneously fail because that current exceeds what it can technically draw, or it overheats it. And then in power devices, gate ruptures, gate burnouts, things like that, which cause failures. And those you test on the ground with similar things. So what causes that in orbit is like protons and heavy ions. And on the ground, we have particle accelerators that recreate those environments. So single event effects testing is a lot harder just because the facilities are rarer and they're really expensive to kind of get access to. And also sample preparation and monitoring things is trickier, but those are kind of like the two main things to do is total ionizing dose and single event effects testing.
Great, thanks, Matt. I guess might be worth just, if you know about it, just going into a little bit more detail into how a bit flip is triggered. So you mentioned the devices can get worse over time. That's one thing. And then the other thing is you get hit in the wrong place by some particle.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what actually happens inside that that SRAM cell, say, or whatever?
If you basically have this charge particle that kind of travels through the silicon and you know it leaves this ionization track of electron hole pairs as it goes through, and then as if it passes near like a sensitive node such as, you know, storage node of an SRAM cell, flip flops, all these sorts of things, the electric field in the depletion region sweeps in some of that charge basically, and some additional charge also diffuses into the region afterwards. But you kind of get these short-lived surges of charge which is injected into the device. And if that collected charge exceeds the critical charge of that sort of section, you kind of get some sort of malfunction. So whether that's a bit flip, whether that's like a gate opening and kind of more current flowing, those sorts of things. So each technology tends to have a minimum charge needed for a bit to flip or something like that to happen. And a lot of that is dependent on things like the feature size of the technology. You know, the larger the feature size, the higher the critical charges and device structures and things like that, which gets definitely weeds and at that point well beyond what I know very well.
Okay. So one of the other questions we got from Troy Byrne was, what does a hardened PDK and tooling look like? I guess maybe that's quite semiconductor VLSI specific. Is that something that you know about?
That's that, not so much. I think that you might need someone that's kind of more, has a bit more kind of expertise in the area. There are a bunch of like methodologies. So there are a bunch of things that kind of help. So actually, interestingly, there's kind of, when people, if you go online and you look at Texas Instruments, for example, you can see a bunch of rad-hard devices that space grade. And depending on who's manufacturing them and what they are, there's kind of like two approaches to those parts being space grade. Either they tested them and they got lucky and they behaved pretty well, or they were inherently designed from scratch. So there's a whole series of parts where, you know, the the part you might buy on Mouser or DigiKey will be exactly the same as a space-grade part. It's just like the lots are kind of controlled and the paperwork comes with it. And then there's the other side of things, like for a good example of this would be power MOSFETs. You know, rad-hard power MOSFETs are typically designed specifically to handle that. So there's kind of like those two ways that people go. And in integrated circuits, there's definitely a bunch of kind of techniques that people use to kind of improve it. Some of them are more modern, some of them are a little older, essentially. I'm trying to find like a list of some of the notes that I had on this, but I'm struggling to find them in the background right now. I think that the main thing that there are certain technologies which are inherently better, like SOI technologies tend to perform a little better just because the way like the insulator layers and things are stacked up and stuff like that. But again, like this starts to get like well beyond where my knowledge is, because you know there are people that go and specifically pick, you know, an integrated circuit that was designed on using an SOI process. And that doesn't guarantee that it's going to be good. More than likely it might be, but none of these things are kind of guarantees. There's so many other things which factor into it. So it really gets down to someone that kind of has to design those ICs basically.
Yeah. It's on a slight tangent, but I brought a product to market and we had to do CE testing. And part of that was satisfying ESD, electrostatic discharge. And I read a book to prepare myself. And one of the metaphors about electrostatic discharge is you're firing a shotgun through a spinning bicycle wheel, because you don't know what your circuit is going to be doing at the moment when it gets disrupted. And so you could fire that shotgun through there. Bicycle wheel 10 times and never hit a spoke, and you hit a spoke but the other spokes hold fine and you pass the test, but on a different day you could have hit just in the wrong place and your design fails. And I'm just wondering, like with radiation, do you ever get like the same kind of thing where you can get lucky on a test, or is the volume of the shots coming from the shotgun so high that statistically after an hour of testing you're completely certain about its performance in space?
This is kind of like a lot of where the standards and the numbers that people go with for how you test. So those single event effects I described, you have to test to quite high particle numbers that are very statistically significant, and also to try and make sure like you hit the spokes. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's obviously concerns when there's a few different things. Like one, it has to be statistically significant enough, like if the part doesn't fail, making sure that doesn't fail on space, and that's in space whether you're flying one part or whether you're flying 100 of those parts on 100 satellites, which is statistically a very different scenario. You kind of need to make sure that the test kind of covers that. So you're making sure that you do kind of like, you know, hit all the spokes to some extent, but then it also gets concerning when you start looking at really small feature size, you know, modern ASICs, because you also need to make sure that you have enough particles going through all those different locations as well, which gets tricky. Like that, you're not necessarily getting a statistically significant number of particles going through all those points. So, you know, people kind of worry about that, and then also like, you know, the different modes that you're in. So the main thing is like you kind of do overkill in the number of particles you're firing at it, and you operate the parts in a representative condition. So, you know, there may be duty cycling, there may be changes in states, but overall you should be just about covering all of those bases, but it's not a guarantee.
Yeah.
It's a risk.
Okay. So on our satellite, we have an RP 2340, is that right, Pat? Yeah.
Just a standard 2040 plus on chip.
Now I think that's 45 nanometer process from what I remember. If anyone knows better, feel free to connect me. And then we've also got our ASIC, which is 130 nanometers. So from what you've just said, it sounds like they will both be degrading over time with this total ionizing dose. But if something kind of goes wrong in a bit flip way, it's probably much more likely to be the RP2040 because it's on a 3x smaller node size.
In principle, there are some kind of scaling rules which apply to a lot of these things with like the size of those. Actually, there's a really good paper about this, and there's several really good papers about this topic.
Yeah,
one of them is really good that looks specifically at a bunch of ADCs where they looked at all these different feature sizes and other things, and they found that there are trends, but there's so much spread across those trends that it's almost impossible to say like one is going to be better than the other. So you know, it's like that. The problem with trends is that, like, you know, there may be so much different stuff going on with these different parts that they'll, in principle, if you had like 100 different parts of this kind of like feature size and 100 of the other, you'd be able to draw a line and see the difference. But picking two points, they could be all over the place because there is just such a widespread in how behavior is. Like, it's just really hard to predict, which is one of the reasons people end up having to do so much testing, is there's just very little guaranteed in the world.
No way of performing a field repair.
I think I understood that with the TID, smaller features like the thinner gates are less susceptible because they have less room to accumulate crap. So TID gets better with shrinking feature size, but single bit flips like get worse because it's a smaller thing to twitch. I think that's what I got. I'm not sure if that's true.
So there's several things. I want you to bring up. Let me try and share this. I'll put this in. There is this. I should put together a couple of kind of things I dragged out that answered some of these questions. Most of them, it's just words. It doesn't really help to know anything. So this here is the paper references to the bottom here. I apologize, that looks a little funky, but this is for a bunch of ATD converters. This is a selection of figures. So this one here talks about the total ionizing dose threshold for a functional failure, and actually it's better at higher feature sizes. And there are several things which affect, you know, this. It's not just feature size. It's like also like, you know, I'm not fundamentally sure on how these devices are designed, but there's things like oxide gate thicknesses and stuff like that, which all make a difference in technologies they're based on. But that seems to be the trend. But the fun thing here is when you look at, you know, latch-up thresholds, and, you know, people talk about there being trends, but the whole thing is like a wild spread. So it's, and even on with the TID thing, there's a wild spread for things with similar feature sizes and similar technologies. And it's really hard to predict anything. So, you know, there are trends in there, but the trends aren't good enough to ever kind of give you enough information to predict something. It's random luck almost with a lot of parts.
So there are no rules of thumb or is it just bigger better?
Yeah, the bigger it tends to be better. There are rules of thumb. I mean, for a lot, especially in most applications. So we talked about total ionizing dose as a thing. In most low Earth orbit environments, total ionizing doses are so low that it's not even a concern. So if you're in a spacecraft with just a couple of millimeters of aluminium shielding in low Earth orbit, they will never see a dose that would likely cause them to fail. And that threshold's usually around about 5 kilorad, which is an abstract number if you're not used to it. But, you know, in some environments, you get up to 30 or even 100 kilorad and you use parts in that category. But nearly all commercial parts will be fine up to about 5 kilorad. So if you have a satellite in an orbit with enough shielding to keep it below that, which most low Earth orbit satellites are, you kind of don't have to worry about that. So the thing people usually worry about more is single event effects, because they are statistical in a way. So it's like, you know, it's a probabilistic event. It could happen at day one, it could happen at day 100 or 1,000. If you have a mean time to failure of 10 years, that kind of sounds good, but actually, you know, that still means you have quite a reasonable chance of failing in the first couple of years of a mission. So you're looking for really good statistical certainty that something doesn't kind of fail. And that's kind of the tricky thing that a lot of people have to grapple with radiation testing.
Yeah, so maybe let's just dig a little bit deeper into what kind of environment we're expecting in low Earth orbit, because that's where our satellite is. So you just mentioned that. I think the chip has no shielding whatsoever. It's just, I don't know if you've seen a photo of the satellite, but it's just flopped out in space.
It's naked. It's right floating out there. Out on
Earth.
Yeah.
That's gonna hurt. That's gonna really hurt. They're just dangling it out there. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The system, I think there's a redundant pair of Raspberry Pi microchips inside the body of the satellite that are shielded by the just PCB, like FR4 fiberglass. Yeah. And they can take over from each other if something goes wrong. But our ASIC is just literally in the void.
So I'll go back to this is a very long presentation on training material I'd give to some folks, which is like not something you want to sit through for 2 hours. But this is kind of what I use to kind of like stick all my pictures in for things. So this is kind of like the useful, this is from a reference, and it's probably the nicest picture of understanding what the kind of environment is. Mm. So low Earth orbit, like the International Space Station is kind of here. And we have these two things called the Van Allen belts. And those are where basically charged particles get stuck on the Earth's magnetic field. So if you ever have basic kind of like, magnetic theory, that's what happens. You have more protons on the inner belt, which is this tiny one here, which is quite close to where Leo is. And you have more electrons in the outer belt. And if you're in a polar orbit, which I believe you probably are, you kind of pass through and clip some of those a little bit. And that's the bit that kind of hurts, essentially. So you're mostly going to be seeing this kind of low Earth orbit environment. Now, there's also like particles from the sun, from solar flares and cosmic rays. They're to some extent protected. You can kind of see they're like shaped around here by the Earth's magnetic field. So if you're way out in geostationary orbit, you see a lot more of those. If you're in Leo, you don't see it as much. But if you're doing a polar orbit, you kind of pop out of this protected zone and you see those. So what you'll see is a bunch of charged electrons hitting all of your stuff, a bunch of protons, and then, like I said, every element in the periodic table is going to be flying through all your parts. And if it's exposed as well, there's another small risk of charging events. So one of the problems with the kind of high electron environment is that if you have things that are exposed, you can get quite high surface charging as well, and things can go to extremely high potentials when you go over the poles, at least. So you could actually see, if you don't have a conductive coating on the outside of everything, you could see like some of the potentials on those external surfaces reaching like hundreds, if not thousands, of volts.
Wow.
It's not a nice environment.
Let's start these experiments as soon as possible, Pat.
Quick.
Meantime, before failure one day. So I think that was a question from Sylvain. Another one was, how would that affect classic CMOS, which I think we've already spoken about, 130 nanometers. Another question from Sylvain is, could we build some kind of sensor design into our ASIC for next time so that we can measure some of these effects while we're in orbit?
So I mean, there's measuring the effect it has on your parts. So, you could looking at what telemetry you get out. So, if you're having memory errors or signal trends, you could try to measure those. You could measure parametric degradation or the current draw and things like that. In terms of measuring the environment, there's actually some really handy, as an Irish company called Veradis, they make RadFETs, and they're making these very handy little modules. So the next time you're doing something like this, you can kind of bolt one of those things on, or even glue it down almost. And they're calibrated, and they're passive. So you could turn them on every so often and take a reading of what the dose is that your parts have seen. So you can actually see what the real-time environment is that your parts are being exposed to as well, which is something that a lot of people are doing now, because you know what we expect to see on orbit is not always what we see, because it's all based on models and interpretations and then an awful lot of margin that's added into all of it. So a lot of people are flying simple dosimeters to actually measure exactly what it is that they're experiencing.
Okay. I think we've got just another couple of questions that were submitted before the interview, and I see we've got another few questions coming up. So get to the questions in the chat in a minute. A question that we got from Iami is, how do you see the open source silicon movement intersecting with space or high reliability applications? And let me just give you a bit more context, because you probably don't know much about what we're doing. One of the chips that we make are multi-project chips. So we put like hundreds of chips onto one ASIC, and then that's the chip that we ship to people or send to space. And because we're also using open source tools, and then sharing the cost of a multi-project chip on a multi-project wafer, people are doing chip designs and testing them for like as little as 150 euros or so. And then this satellite spot that we got was actually free this first time, but we'd probably have to pay like a couple of thousand euros for the next one. So then if we split that between the 20 people who had their experiments on, that means you can design something to test in on a chip in space and fly it for about 200 euros, say. And also you don't have to pay for these expensive tools. Of course, like our tools don't do things like tell you what's likely to happen with a total ionizing dose of XYZ. But I just wanted to get I think this is what Iami's getting at, is like, you come from a world where it's like extremely expensive to do this kind of stuff, and potentially there's a way of doing it a lot cheaper. Do you think that like, how do you see the possibilities in the future of kind of the open source silicon world contributing to testing stuff in space?
Yeah, so I mean, this is entirely my opinion, but I'll tell you some of the trends that I see in general. And a lot of it is that, you know, the reason it was so cheap to put that stuff in space is because, you know, there's this new space movement is doing things cheaper, faster, etc., which is really interesting. And the thing that is tricky is that, you know, there are rad hard parts or parts which have rad hard data, which are very expensive, and people are making slightly cheaper versions. You know, companies have like lines of, call them rad tolerant instead, and they're slightly cheaper and have less information that goes with them. And ultimately what costs the most there is the testing and the documentation that comes with it. Like it's not the design of the part or any of that. And quite a lot of new space companies don't want that. They'd rather take more risk and fly a commercial part that is similar to that rather than actually using the rad hard part. Whether that's a good idea or not, you know, remains to be seen in the future. But people don't want to pay for that. They want to do things faster and cheaper. They would like to know that parts are more robust and have had designs and things implemented that mean that they'll behave better in a radiation environment. And if there's some way that the open source community can start designing, you know, some of these parts which are designed to be more radiation tolerant, not even necessarily testing them, just flying them and then providing them to people as components that they can actually just like purchase and use, rather than having to go through, you know, a rad hard parts vendor that's going to, you know, for you know, insurance purposes and a bunch of other things, only sell a rad tolerant part at an extremely high cost with a ton of paperwork. There was no paperwork, just the fact that someone's kind of done half of the work. People would be very interested in that. I could see that being a very valuable thing, especially in some of the areas where there's so many components out there that people want to use, and they can't because, you know, there aren't rad tolerant versions, or there aren't that many commercial versions that they can kind of switch parts out to. So there's a lot of things out there where they'd be like, yes, there will be a huge benefit to the community for something like this, definitely.
Maybe even the limitations that we have with our multi-project wafers, where we only get 100 parts back from an order. That's like less of a problem if you're building satellites because you're only building a couple.
Oh yeah, I mean that's also the problem. Like, why rad hard parts are expensive is like if every car was using rad hard parts, the rad hard parts become cheap because there'd be a lot of them, right? So it's the small quantities which cause the problems as well. So yeah, it wouldn't be a problem at all.
Okay, so that's all the questions we had that were prepared for you. In advance, there were some more that I'm not going to ask you because like, I know they're kind of too related to VLSI design techniques and stuff like that. So we'll get somebody else to come and help to answer those. But just going back through the questions in the chat, what kind of things could we do for shielding? So one of the things that was just suggested by Kay was, could we like put one of these RF cans over the top? If our chip is just out there in space, just putting a little piece of metal over the top of it might help.
So honestly, any amount of shielding would help. Conduction material to get rid of charging effects, but any shielding would help. I have a, let me find this other part that I can let's do this one. Yeah, this makes sense. So this kind of sorry, for some reason I accidentally zoomed in massively on my screen, so I have to move around to find things, but So this here kind of shows you in different orbits the doses versus the amount of shielding you have. Now obviously the encapsulation of your parts will provide some shielding, so you're not going to be far out to the left here. But this is kind of like, you know, I said that the 5 kilorad number is the number that things are kind of, you know, when nothing really fails. But this is megarad per year. And if you're down at the, you know, the first few microns of the material, see like huge, huge doses. Then as you add, you go from like 0.1 micron to 1 micron, you see a 10x drop. 1 micron to 10 microns, another 10x drop. You know, once you start getting up to millimeters, you're kind of down in the much lower levels. So even adding some foil or an MRI blanket over it would definitely help. But the standard thing is people just put like an aluminium box that's like a millimeter or 2 millimeters over the top, and that kind of does the job. There are materials that are inherently better, but aluminium is very good and also very cheap, so that's
light as well. Yes.
Yeah.
When you see that gold foil on satellites, is that like related to shielding stuff?
So the thing that looks like gold foil is one or two things. A lot of time it's actually multi-thread insulation, so it's kind of like a foil layer or a kind of colored Kapton layer. So it's like multi-layer insulation where it's like layers of foil insulator and other things to kind of act as ways to keep the heat in, basically. Okay. Or I have to keep heat in to stop the things like getting too cold. And also in many cases, like they have reflective layers if they're on the external layer to reflect the sun back out, because you know, things get quite hot if you're just pointing at the sun all the time. And they usually have like conductive coatings on the outside to kind of help with charging issues, you know, those electrons that could charge up, or the kind of environment, plasma environment that can charge up the surfaces. If you have a conductive surface, it doesn't really have an issue. If you have an exposed dielectric surface, they can get to pretty high potentials.
Got one other question from Leonardo asking about vibration, but that's not really related to radiation. But Leonardo, you could I think there were some videos from Tibor or maybe Alba where they were showing the satellites on like a vibrating plate. So they definitely, they do this kind of testing before launch to make sure things stay screwed together and so on. So yeah, definitely. Pat, you've got your hand up.
Yes, I have two questions actually. One is about the environment. Could you describe a little bit about the Van Allen belts? I mean, in a way that the magnetic field protects us from solar winds and stuff, right? But still a lot of charged particles go around in there and make things worse, right? Inside the belts, and in LEO, we're in one of them. And I think I read something about like the Atlantic, the South Atlantic anomaly or something, somewhere where it's like really concentrated. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah. So there's the Van Allen belts, like the Earth's magnetic field kind of protects us from, you know, all these solar particles and these galactic cosmic rays which kind of fly at us. But simultaneously, as those things start to interact with the Earth's magnetic field and you know interact with the Earth's atmosphere, you kind of get like you know electrons and protons and these things being separated. And then you know the way this works is if you have a magnetic field and then you have like an electron or a proton, they start to gyrate and stick on those magnetic fields. So although it protects the Earth, you then kind of get this kind of area where everything is kind of like focused and concentrated a little bit more. And in low Earth orbit, in very low Earth orbit, you're not in much of that Van Allen belt. As you go up above 1,000 kilometers, it gets pretty damn aggressive very, very quickly. But the South Atlantic anomaly is the bit where, because the way the Earth's kind of magnetic field is kind of like is angled, part of it kind of hugs in a little bit closer. So when you're orbiting, you don't really experience the Van Allen belt very much. But in low Earth orbit, you still catch this South Atlantic anomaly, and it kind of hugs in right where. Right over the South Atlantic. So if we have, let me find, we have a nice, I think, here we go. So this is kind of probably in your polar orbit, what your kind of dose distribution looks like. So as you're going over the poles, you kind of get this one bit here, this kind of hot bit in the heat map. Then you also
it's actually over Brazil.
Yeah, it's right here. This is kind of the bit.
So it comes down to, I think we're at something like 500 kilometers. So we're going through that every time, right? Every time we pass there.
Every time you go through that. So statistically speaking, if you have, there are some really cool papers where people kind of save whenever they have a memory error. And if you, you know, go back through the GPS coordinates as to where that happens, there's a hotspot that's always here. So that's where a lot of stuff happens, basically. So if you have
the Bermuda Triangle for satellites.
So some people even talk about some people do things where they don't update firmware in the South Atlantic anomaly. They'll never do it there because they're worried that they're risking doing an update when they could have a memory error and that would just potentially brick everything. So there are some fun things that people do to try and avoid the Bermuda Triangle, basically.
Wow. Okay. And the other question I had was about the static accumulation. We're out there basically rubbing against electrons and accumulating charge, right? And charge would accumulate on dielectrics and it would accumulate on carb bits, right? Pointy bits, I would assume. Because of the worry.
There is a thing about pointy bits. It doesn't, I don't know, this gets kind of a little out of my area of expertise. The pointy bits matters for things like certain things that are exposed, people really care about the pointy bits, like in solar panels and solar arrays, and that factors in. I've never really considered it for an exposed part, but I think, let me see if I have it here.
So I'm just wondering if we coated the corners, let's say, if we exposed some metal there and grounded that, make kind of a lightning rod, would that help?
Not so much. So basically what happens is you get, the sun shines on any metal that's nearby, and it kind of, you get a photoelectric effect. So electrons pop off and that stuff gets charged positive a little bit. And then the surrounding plasma environment you pass through charges all the dielectric materials negative. And this is kind of like a very worst case scenario of what they can get to. It's all based on solar activity and things. But in some orbits, you can see like those dielectrics or the differential between a dielectric and a metal to be like, you know, hundreds of volts and higher up, you know, tens of thousands of volts. And basically the risk is that you have a discharge between those differentially charged parts. So it really does depend on, you know, this doesn't matter for a lot of stuff if it's not near anything sensitive, but if you have a, you know, if you have an exposed ASIC, then that there is a risk that you're going to see some ESD events that could cause problems. Yeah. So the way people deal with this typically is it's normally more of a concern for materials and antennas. Antennas obviously making sense that they're exposed and they have a mix of things. So internal to the spacecraft, this isn't an issue. External to the spacecraft, it is. So materials typically are covered in a conductive coating, which kind of helps with making sure that everything is kind of like grounded and you don't get differential charges building up.
We've got a question from Sunka asking about single event upsets, detection and reset logic. But I guess that's outside your area of expertise.
Not so much. So, I mean, a lot of the stuff that happens then is done external to the component design. So, you know, if you work with any modern microcontrollers or FPGAs, a lot of them have error correction code built into them on all the memory. So it's almost an option that you can switch on where you basically have the ability to do single error correction and double error detection. It's kind of like a miracle almost thing where basically, you know, you're highly likely to get, especially in volatile memory, you're going to see an awful lot of memory errors happening. And if you have error correction codes on those that memory, it becomes almost a non-problem. There are also other solutions that people look at, like triple modular redundancy and voting schemes, or other things where, you know, for example, really popular microcontrollers like ATI Hercules microcontroller had like a dual core kind of lockstep. So there are things where they can kind of like, you know, is one thing wrong? Let's correct it. Or, you know, best of three, what's the actual answer and see if there's something wrong. So there are schemes you can do outside of the chip design that can help with this.
Yeah, in fact, we've got, I don't think it's on TT06, but we definitely had a three-way voting system design that was taped out on a recent Tiny Tape Out. And there's a Yosys plugin that is kind of in development that does triple modular redundancy. So you can like select a bunch of logic and say, triplicate this, and then the Yosys will do that for you. It's a work in progress, but we had him. We had the guy who designed that recently on one of the Yosys user group meetups. Okay, I see Eric's got a question. Eric, go for it.
Actually, I have two questions. The first one is, as everybody knows, when you manufacture wafers as part of the VLSI process, there's like a huge amount of variability. And so the manufacturing test process has a lot of techniques for finding like single bit failures, finding weak and slow transistors, you know, out of a sea of like a billion transistors. And so I was wondering, do you guys take advantage of any of those systems in space, like post-manufacturing, to actually find defects, like to get kind of telemetry on the parts themselves? And then the other thing I was wondering is, radiation is like one thing that makes space hard, but I imagine like thermal might even be harder. And so I was wondering, like, how do you deal with like a temperature budget and stuff like that?
Okay, that's a good question, definitely. So I'm gonna do a politician thing and the first question answer what I know, which isn't necessarily gonna answer what you're asking at all. But I think the thing you're kind of getting at there is like there's an awful lot to do with like wafer die and lot numbers and lot control, and that's a really big thing. So, you know, again, it's not as done as much in newer space applications, but in more traditional aerospace applications, like lot control of your parts is important. Like if you test a part, you need to make sure that the rest of the parts come from the same lot, and making sure that that lot has got like, you know, controls on things like the die and the wafer processors, because things can change. It's not unheard of, you know, if you go on DigiKey and you have a part which you find a part that behaves really well from a radiation standpoint, you buy another one, it might not behave the same because either some of the manufacturing processes may have changed, it could be made in a different fab. You know, there are some components which are actually made in a couple of fabs, so you don't know which one you're getting. You know, like the things which check, things, small things can change which make a big difference to actually those part, that part performance. And even within a lot, you can have within lot variability of parts and things. So it's like it's a minefield. A lot of the time you kind of work around it with things like over testing and adding in margin. So if there is some lot variability and performance drops, it's fine. But with a lot of stuff, you kind of need to have that kind of like control of all of those things, which is super difficult, especially, you know, it's easy for big companies with large budgets to do. It's very difficult for small budgets trying to do new space applications. And they just have to kind of accept that as a risk and ignore it a lot of the time.
And my second question was about thermals.
Thermal is tricky. So thermal management is like, I say one of the good thermal engineers in the space industry are like very sought after. So there's a lot of things that you need to do because things kind of get way too hot because you're sun pointing too much, or they can get way too cold. And you can also end up with massive temperature differentials across things. So a lot of analysis is done very early on, and people look at power budgets to work out where things are getting hot and cold, and then things like, you know, modular insulation to keep things warm or exposing things to keep them cooler, and then in some cases even survival heaters for cold temperatures. So, you know, there are ways to be able to design to keep things within a tight temperature range, but it's pretty common to expect, like, you know, a lot of your parts to go through like minus 40 to plus 60 or even 100 Celsius. It's not like that temperature swing would not be unheard of, or be done as part of a qualification, at least, even if you keep the temperature profile closer than that. You do qualification at a wider range just to make sure that you have margin on that, and do a lot of thermal cycles to stress the design because of, you know, component reliability and you know, CTE issues and solder cracks and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, so our little unexposed chip is going to just be right out there in the sun.
It's going to get real hot. It's going to get real cold. Yeah.
Yeah. What actual? Because one of the experiments that we've got on there is a ring oscillator, so we're measuring the frequency of the ring oscillator to track the temperature. So if you had to guess, what would you guess the range would be?
Something exposed and going through, the other question is, like, there's a lot of stuff in this, like, is it attached to a lot of mass, or is it really just like,
we should show you a photo, let me see if I can find one for you. But no, essentially it's not.
So that means it's going to be wide. Like I would expect like, you know, minus 50 to 100 C, if not wider than that, I would say. Okay. A friend of mine made some really small CubeSats, which weren't even like 1U, they were like a third of U. Yeah. And that thing was temperature cycles to make sure that everything survived, because like that was the most brutal part of it.
We have one mounting point right in the middle that is basically where all our thermal is going through, like through the ground hole there. But it's a little board, like one of those little squares there, the little rectangles, yeah.
And this thing, this top bit, like, pops out, so it's just
it's really okay. Right. Yeah, that's gonna be fun. Okay, yeah, I'm actually kind of excited about that, because that makes everything way cooler. But I would definitely start testing those things sooner before like thermal cycles start like deteriorating. Okay, get it on and get some data soon.
I was getting the tab ready to share, so I actually missed what your estimate was. Can you repeat it?
I guess, like, you know, minus 50 to 100.
Really? 150 degrees.
Yeah, I would say that wouldn't be uncommon, just because like when you're in shade, it gets
cold.
There's no thermal mass there to keep it warm, and then similarly when you get in the sun, it's gonna get really hot. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to some nice sine waves from the when we plot the
you managed to get data through an entire like eclipse and some kind of orbit. That would be very interesting to see. That'd be very cool.
Well, yeah, we do hope to get that. We've got the experiment set up to run like that. So we'll share anything we get with you, in case it's at all interesting for you, I'm sure.
Oh, it's definitely interesting. Yeah, it's all a lot of fun.
Kay, we've got time for maybe one more question, Kay.
For sure. So as someone that is definitely not a thermal engineer, I was curious, is there anything that is the analog of inductors and capacitors, except for managing thermal transients as opposed to electrical transients?
Water.
Yeah.
Like you need mass. That's the thing. It's like if you have your hardware in good thermal contact with a large mass block, it helps, because it just dampens out all of those temperature cycles, essentially. If you don't have a lot of mass and you don't have good thermal contact with things, you're going to see big swings, essentially. Yeah,
you said a lot of masks.
Mass. So it's just like, you know, you just got like boiling a kettle with a little bit of water and it's really fast. Boiling a kettle with a ton of water is really slow. So you want to, if you can think of your heating and cooling cycles are relatively short, so the more mass you have, the less you'll be able to kind of like shift the temperature in that large volume or that large mass of material. So it's kind of like, that's kind of like a terrible analogy, but the only thing I could think of on the spot.
But,
there.
Yeah, but the, and then the more expensive it is, so it's like that classic engineering trade-off. Awesome. Okay. Well,
pleasantly surprised with how it all works out. Like, people think space is really severe, and then they surprise themselves with how well everything does sometimes. It's not always the case, but the amount of times people are like, this shouldn't be working this well, and things do. So, like, I'm feeling positive for you guys.
Yeah, good. Cool. Well, thanks again, Matthew, for your time and answering all our questions and being patient with us. Really appreciate you coming along. Let's give Matthew a round of applause, everybody.